Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Zingari. EverDirect, Carl Pilkington, in An Idiot Abroad, said, quote, "It's interesting to see that people had so much clutter even thousands of years ago. The only way to get rid of it was to bury it, and then some archaeologist went and dug it all up." Well, Carl isn't 100% wrong, but he does admit the part that archaeologists can give us an amazing picture of how past civilizations lived, what they ate, and how long they inhabited specific areas. We're going to dig deep today into Vermont's past and sift through what has been buried by those who lived here before us. Taking us on that journey in the past is Vermont State Archaeologist Jess Robinson. Jess, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks a lot for having me, Rick.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you've got a question for Jess or if you've uncovered an interesting artifact on your property, you can give us a call, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Jess, is Vermont a good place for archaeological excavation? In other words, has there been much human habitation here before us, despite these cold climates that we've had?
Yeah, it's good is a relative term. In terms of what archaeology has revealed over the history of professional and, you know, pre-professional archaeology, we have uncovered about 12,500 years of human habitation in Vermont. The vast majority of that, up until about 500 years ago, was Native American occupation. The Abnaki and Proto-Abnaki and their ancient ancestors. So yes, it is remarkable at what has been revealed in terms of the depth and intensity in a number of time periods of the human occupation in the state. Now, good, our, like you say, our preservation isn't great. Mm-hmm. We have freeze thaw, wet dry, and acidic sort of soils from all the forest covers. So we don't preserve in many cases some of the things that in the desert southwest they might find. But all that means is that we as archaeologists have to get more creative and utilize and in some cases invent better techniques for analyzing what is there.
So we found habitation remains back 12,500 years. Is that how far back we think Vermont had people, or is that just part of how far back we go?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we're pushing right up against the limit at around 12,500 about when people could live here. It's possible that there's slightly earlier habitations, 12,700, 12,800. Those haven't been found yet, but they could potentially be here. But pretty much before that, glaciers were covering at least part of Vermont, and then once they receded, it was pretty much a completely denuded landscape for a few hundred years until trees and plants, shrubs came back, and then the animals followed them in. Mm-hmm. So for a while, it was pretty impossible to live here. Either there was a mile of ice over you, or it was just rock and water and ice.
Gotcha.
So yeah, we're pushing really at the limit at around 12,500, maybe 12,800, about when people could physically live here.
That's impressive. So what type of evidence do we have from going back, you know, that far, back 12,500 years?
Yeah, well, Vermont is really cool in this area, not only for us as a state and as a region, but actually internationally, because the Paleo-Indian period, as it's called, which basically means Old Indian. It's sort of an unfortunate term, but archaeologists continue to use it, mm-hmm. Was a time when sea levels were much lower. And so we know from places like Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard, which are now islands that have Paleo-Indian presence, that people could walk out to them. There were hills out there. Much of the continental shelf was exposed, and people have found mammoth remains and scallop draggers and even artifacts. So we know that people were way out in those continental shelves. And what they were doing out there, were they fishing? Were they sea mammal hunting? Well, we're not really sure, because it's very difficult to study those sites because they're now under hundreds of feet of water in many cases. But in Vermont, 13,000 to about 10,000 years ago, there was an arm of the Atlantic Ocean that filled the Champlain Basin. After the glaciers receded, the land was so compressed from all the way to the glaciers, it was actually lower than sea level. And when there was an outlet to the St. Lawrence, seawater ran in and filled what's now Lake Champlain, but was then an arm of the sea for about 3,000 years.
And, is this the Champlain Sea?
This is the Champlain Sea. So gotcha. It hosted whales and seals, cod. You know, it was a very, very biotically or environmentally productive area. And Paleo-Indians were utilizing these landforms. And the reason we know that is because, unlike the continental shelf, which is now drowned, our sea levels have risen. The land has rebounded. And so we are one of the only places really in North America that's preserved these raised shorelines that are 13,000, 10,000 years old. So we can see how the Paleo-Indians mapped themselves onto the landscape. And sure enough, we find these sites are extremely rare, but there are a predominance of them along these ancient shorelines, suggesting that they were maybe fishing or seal hunting, or even hunting for whales, shellfishing, things that 20 years ago we would have never thought about with Paleo-Indians. There's sort of this thought that they were big game hunters, woolly mammoth hunters, caribou hunters.
Right.
And you know, our research, my colleagues and my research has really shown that no, they were probably actually much more broad-based and utilizing these important maritime resources.
Interesting. So what do we have that's from, you know, 10 or 12,000 years ago?
So primarily it's the remains of stone tools, and how they're arrayed across a site can tell us a lot. And fortunately, during this time period, you might think, oh, they're the oldest, so maybe they're the most quote-unquote primitive, or they had the least complex technology.
Right.
The opposite is actually true for Paleo-Indians. They were the master craftspeople of stone tools. They made beautiful stone tools, expertly crafted in a variety of shapes and forms. And interestingly, they preferred stone from far-flung locales, from northern Maine, from a mountain in New Hampshire, from Pennsylvania, from the Hudson Valley. So, for instance, at a site in Williston, a very important site in Williston, we found materials from all those places. Straight line distance from the most far-flung was something like 800 kilometers, all represented at this one site.
Oh,
and so
man.
You can really tell a lot just through the stone, but we also have occasionally the remains of fire pits, bone tools, not so much the things like basketry or other clothing, because that has long since eroded away.
Right.
But again, we can make careful inferences by noting where things were in the ground, how they relate to each other, and try to build that picture back in.
And then when you find something like that at that Williston site, how do you determine the age? Do you use carbon dating, or do you know that this shape of a stone implement is consistent with other things found that would be 10,000, 12,000 years old?
Yeah, great question. So we'd use radiocarbon dating a lot, but in terms of these oldest sites, we have not yet found anything that's large enough to radiocarbon date. And so we rely on, like you say, looking at the characteristic shapes of the stone tools, particularly the spear points that they made, because fortunately, they only made these spear points in these particular shapes during certain times of the Paleo-Indian period. They never make them like that again. And in fact, archaeologists are still arguing why they made them that way, because it was so difficult and it resulted in breakage so much of the time that it doesn't seem like, if you were thinking purely sort of expeditiously, it wouldn't have made sense, but yet they did it anyway. And so fortunately, it's a very telltale sign when you find those things that it dates to this particular time period, about this 400 to 500 year slice. You can get it down that far. So we're fortunate. Now we are starting to go through some of the older collections to see if there's anything that was collected that 20 years ago you could have never radiocarbon dated, but now the technology's advanced so much that you actually might be able to. So.
Wow. Okay, I'm sure this varies depending on where it's found, but how deep are you digging to find traces of civilization from 10, 12,000 years ago?
So, good question. So, Paleo-Indians, very interestingly, particularly in the early part of the period, really never lived along the riverside, as opposed to almost every other native occupation going up to European contact. That's probably because the rivers were still cutting into their banks, were very dynamic. It was probably not a great place to be.
They avoided the floodplain.
They avoided the floodplains, wow. Exactly. And so because there's no flood soils building up, you don't have to dig that far. They're usually not that deep in the ground. Because it's been – those artifacts have been there for maybe 12,000 years, there is a lot of down – you know, they do sink into the ground, but sure. Not as far as you might think, you know, a couple feet. Mm-hmm. As opposed to some later occupations, which were on the floodplains, where, you know, we've done excavations in the Intervale where you can go down 15 feet and still be finding artifacts. And they're in a layer cake-like progression, which is wonderful for archaeologists because mm-hmm. you'll find layers that are more recent. Then if you keep digging down, they get older and they get older and they get older. And that's obviously fantastic for us.
So. Oh, fascinating. Jess, how much would habitations in Vermont have changed from, say, 12,500 years ago to, let's say, the birth of Christ and then to the arrival of European settlers?
Yeah, those are some interesting time slices you bring up. So I was actually just in an email chat with my fellow state archaeologists over the past couple of weeks talking about sort of site sizes and do you have sort of statistical analyses. And in Vermont, the size of sites stayed pretty constant from the Paleo-Indian period. Maybe those were a little smaller all the way through right to, you were saying, about 2,000 years ago. And this was a hunter-gatherer, a forest hunter-gatherer fisher landscape. There wasn't a lot of need to get into big groups of people for long periods of time. Now, people would come together seasonally to celebrate for particular feasts, for particular communal activities like nut harvesting or fish runs. But for the most part, people stayed in probably extended family bands, having active communication networks, but not big settlements. And so we have this very long tenure of hunter-gatherer fishers that can tell us really a lot about how people lived on the landscape, particularly when the landscape started to change. But about 2,000 years ago, you do start to see sites noticeably getting bigger, not huge, but bigger, and many more of them. And then around 1000 AD, finally, people in Vermont, native folks in Vermont, the Proto-Abnaki, develop corn, bean, squash agriculture. And unlike their Iroquoian neighbors, it still doesn't appear that they were living year-round in permanent villages. But they were living three and a half seasons in one place. And then villages get quite big because you're going to have to accommodate. You have to be there for the planting, watch the plants, harvest, process. So all of that means you need to stay more or less in one place.
And when you say quite big, what are we talking about?
We've found a few villages from what we call this late woodland time period. We've never looked at all of it because it was usually looked at in advance of some development. So we only looked at the areas that were going to be destroyed, and then the rest is either preserved or was outside of the project area. So we only have little slices. But from what we can extrapolate based on that, you know, a few hundred certainly in a village, maybe up to as many as 500 or 600. Again, some of that's conjecture because we couldn't go out and map every house pattern and do lengths and widths, but that's what we hypothesize.
You've used the terms Paleo-Indian and Proto-Abenaki.
Yeah.
Do we know when the direct descendants or ancestors of the Abenaki did settle here in our area?
Yeah, so certainly there doesn't ever have appeared to have been a time in Vermont from the Paleo-Indian period, likely, but certainly from about 9,000 years ago on, where there was ever not native people in Vermont, and at fairly, you know, not dense, but, you know, fairly consistent populations. You know, yes, there were some rises and falls, and like I said, around 2,000 years ago, you see a definite upswing, but there are always people here. And so when the Abenaki say those are all our ancestors, that's completely legitimate. Archaeologically, there's no way to, you know, doesn't encapsulate genetics or anything like that.
Right.
So we can't say for sure, but that is entirely likely. The language that became the Algonquian language, which Abenaki is a version of, we know came from the Great Lakes around 3,500 years ago. But obviously, language doesn't equal people. And pottery styles that are very indicative of sort of Algonquian groups start to flow as soon as people start making pottery all across the Northeast and Great Lakes region that seem to be mapped onto Algonquian identity, at least, which you could say is a good analog to Abenaki. So probably always, certainly, and always meaning, you know, back to the earliest inhabitants, 12,000, 12,800, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely by 9,000. And then, you know, you can start to see the telltale traces of actually things archaeologically, certainly by around 3,000 years ago.
And were these Native Americans like we are today? Did they tend to congregate, move to the Chittenden County area? Is that where we would have seen them in this area we call Vermont now, or were they more widespread?
Yeah, so it's a great question, and it's one that archaeology currently is having a tough time resolving, because almost all archaeology done in Vermont is done, particularly in the last 3 or 4 decades, has been done in advance of development of some kind. And so a lot of the development occurs in the Champlain Valley, you know, particularly the ones that trigger archaeology, which are large-scale developments and the
right.
big road-building projects and things like that. So if you looked at a map of archaeological sites in Vermont, and as of a couple weeks ago, there were 2,275 Native American archaeological sites documented in our inventory. The vast majority of those in the Champlain Valley. That does not mean that they were not in the eastern part of Vermont. And we have sites documented along the Connecticut as well. But between the Connecticut and the Green Mountains, there's very few documented sites. All that means is that archaeologists have not gone there and looked, because there hasn't been recent large-scale developments that would have triggered federal or state land use laws.
Gotcha.
So we're actually hoping to maybe do some proactive survey on that part of the state in the next couple of years, where, you know, maybe we choose a linear corridor and, you know, choose ponds or rivers or streams and just do some proactive testing.
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting, to that point, that you just don't go proactively looking for sites. Usually it's in response to development, and hence that's why we would see more archaeological sites in areas where there's more development, hence in our case the Chittenden County area. Let's discuss the Champlain Sea. Now, it covered a much larger area than what we know as Lake Champlain today. When was the Champlain Sea in evidence?
Yeah, so this is really interesting. For a long time, we thought that the Champlain Sea had come and gone by the time the first people got here. And geological and environmental science colleagues thought that as well, because they were dating shell from the Champlain Sea. And what it turned out about 10 or 12 years ago was that the shell was holding old carbon in it that was screwing up the radiocarbonates, making them older than they actually were, and some groundbreaking research from some geologists at Middlebury, along with folks from the SUNY New Paltz, SUNY Plattsburgh, and the Geological Survey, instead did sediment cores in the bottom of the lake into the Champlain Sea sediments, and then took plant remains from that time and dated those. And what they found out was the Champlain Sea is much more recent, so started right around 13,000 years ago and continued probably past 10,000 years ago, slowly getting shallower and getting fresher through that time, but continued, you know, pretty recent into 9,500 years ago. And then, interestingly, it appears some recent work by UVM professors, geology professors and grad students has said that probably Missisquoi, portion of the Missisquoi Bay and St. Albans Bay were dry for about, you know, a thousand years. So you could have been able to walk out on them. They were wetland type environments, but they were more or less dry.
All right. And we've got about half a minute, 45 seconds to the break. But how big was the Champlain Sea when it was the full sea?
Yeah, at its biggest, it was huge. It covered a lot of the St. Lawrence lowlands in Quebec. It went out, you know, to portions of Ontario. It filled up at its highest, you know, if we were standing in our part, the southern arm of the Champlain Sea, up to roughly where the box stores would be in Williston, where UVM Medical Center was right now, would be an island in the Champlain Sea. So it was big.
All right. We're going to go sailing on the sea after the break. We're going to take a break now, though. CBS News. Then we'll be back for more with state archaeologist Jess Robinson. Listeners, to join the discussion, you can call us at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. And the Sox continue their series at the Trop tonight against the Rays. Our coverage begins at 6:10, first pitch at 7:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. We're knee-deep in the archaeology of Vermont this hour with state archaeologist Jess Robinson. Listeners, to ask Jess a question or share a comment, you can give us a call, 244-1777-877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Jess, we were talking about the Champlain Sea before we went to the break, and it covered a large area, Quebec to Ottawa, and it seemed like our coast, though, is pretty much the same. You said it covered maybe into Williston. Now, if a Native American in Vermont at the time were to take a canoe into the Champlain Sea, would we have seen travel from those other areas that bordered the Champlain Sea of the time?
Yeah, so it's a great question, and as I was saying earlier, 20 years ago, people would not really have considered that, most people. Paleo-Indians had this sort of interpretation, reputation as being sort of terrestrial big game hunters. And the thought of them building watercraft was seen as sort of far-fetched. Still, it's not, you know, a mainstream opinion. But my colleagues, Weatherby Dorshow from Earth Analytic, which is a GIS firm out in New Mexico, and John Kroc, a professor at the University of Vermont Anthropology Program, we did some analyses looking at the best ways to travel around the region, doing what's called least cost path analysis, basically what's the easiest way to get from somewhere to somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned that Paleo-Indians had this really interesting predilection for fine tool stone from across the region. And that's great for archaeologists because we know where those stone came from. So we can query these things like, if I was in Williston, what's the easiest way to get to Northern Maine where this source is? Mm-hmm. And what we were able to see is that by far the easiest way to get to that source and a number of others was just to go along the Champlain Sea. Now, can we say they were using watercraft? It's probable. Also, they could have waited in the winter where the there would probably have been land fast ice. And the reason we know that is there's some seal remains that have been found in the Champlain Sea sediments that really only rear on land fast pack ice. And so we can say that in the winter, they probably could have used something like dog sleds and gone over the winter ice as well, which is another possibility. They could also have just walked along the beach margins as well. But if you're spending that much time near the sea, you know, you might have been able to make boats. Now, the problem is there weren't a lot of trees around, and so they probably would have had to have been skin boats. But certainly that's entirely possible that they had and utilized those technologies. We haven't found those yet, so this is somewhat conjecture. But we're looking at the predominance of evidence. And
but you do have a canoe of some sort, don't you? Wood canoe?
Yeah, that's much more recent. That's at the Archaeology Heritage Center, where I spend a good deal of my time. It's sort of the state's archaeology curation facility and research space. And that was found in Shelburne Pond in 1979. And that was radiocarbon dated to about 1500 AD. So probably prior to Europeans were here, but on the other end of the time frame in terms of, you know, pre-European archaeology.
It's a new model.
It's a new model.
Hey, let's talk about the Heritage Center. It's in Barrie. Where is it located?
It's at 16 Washington Street in Barrie. We share the space with the Vermont Historical Society's Leahy Library, also their administrative offices, and also the Vermont State Libraries are there. But we have a nice spot on the second floor.
So. That's a beautiful building. It was the high school at one time, is that right?
It was, yeah, the Spalding Graded School.
So, yeah. Oh, I love that. And is it reopened now? Can people come or is it still
– It is, closed? Yeah. I'm there 2 days a week now. That might change to even be there more in the coming months. I'm still sorting that out. But, yeah, minimally Tuesdays and Thursdays I will be there now. So except for today.
That's right. But you can find information on that on the state website. Now, the coverage of the Champlain Sea is this why we find things like the remains of the Charlotte Whale or up in Isle Lamott, the fossils there, because of the coverage of the Champlain Sea? Or am I mixing up time frames?
Yeah, so the former, the Charlotte Whale, absolutely. That's a white or beluga whale that is definitely from the time of the Champlain Sea, likely the early end of the time frame, probably really close to around 13,000 years ago. The fossils in Isle Lamott are much older. I'm not an expert on those, but we're talking, I think, several hundred million or 100 million years older.
Yeah.
And that's when that area was under the ocean. I don't know the geological time period offhand. My colleagues at the geology department, UVM, would certainly be able to tell you. But yeah, this is certainly pre-human, mammal,
right.
You know, so.
Okay. I thought I had, that definitely confused, conflated. But let's talk about that Champlain Sea again. So again, we talked about how this stretched as far west as Ottawa, Ontario, up covering Quebec City. When did it really start to recede and become what we know now as Lake Champlain?
Yeah, so like I mentioned, the weight of the glaciers, the sheer weight of the ice, compressed the land in the Champlain Basin, and particularly compressed the land in the north, where the glaciers were there the longest, more than in the south. So it's a little bit tricky to imagine, but as the glaciers started to melt and recede, first, all that meltwater filled the Champlain Basin, and it formed a freshwater lake named Lake Vermont, which at its largest was actually confluent or joined with another lake further south in the Hudson Valley called Glacial Lake Albany that went all the way down to Long Island, filled with meltwater. And at some point, I can't remember the number off my head. I do know it. it burst, and all of that water catastrophically flooded out, hundreds of feet of that water at one time. So if you can imagine, like, standing on Mount Philo and basically watching Lake Champlain drain, like, in a matter of hours, that's what it would have been like, just a catastrophic drainage out into the sort of what's now Long Island Sound area. Mm-hmm. And there's some people that think that that combined with a couple other glacial lake drainages might have triggered a global cooling event, basically, called the Younger Dryas. And people are actually studying that to study what might happen in the future with climate change. Because basically, if you throw that much fresh water into the Atlantic at one time, you stop the sort of conveyor belt of, the Gulf Stream, shallow, salt, deep. So that's one of the reasons what might have happened. But then that glacial lake drained, it filled back up again, and then it drained north, and then the Champlain Sea formed in that now vacant basin. And then slowly over time, like a sponge that's been compressed, the land, which was smushed down, started to get unsmushed, or, slowly rise back up. And as that happened, the sea began to drain and get shallower, and then as meltwater's running in from all the various inputs, it became fresher until a point that it was no longer joined with the Atlantic Ocean anymore. It rose up too high, and then it became the lake like we know it today.
Now, I did listen to one of your talks where you mentioned the number of rivers or tributaries that feed Lake Champlain as opposed to, like, the Great Lakes. So was that the case at the time of the Champlain Sea, and what effect would that have had on the people living here?
Yeah, so I don't know the exact square mileage off the top of my head, but Lake Champlain has a huge sort of watershed area.
Right.
Relative to other lakes, it's enormous, and it makes kind of sense because we're surrounded by two significant mountain chains on almost all sides, and all that water is running into the lake. Now, if you go back to the Paleo-Indian period, 12 or 10,000 years ago, it's a little bit more conjecture because a lot of those streams and rivers were still cutting through their banks. They were moving all over. The streams were still developing. So, how many there were back at that time period is a little bit of a guess. When you look in a particular stream bed now, there's that big drainage, those cutting incised banks. That's all, a result of 9,000 years of downcutting or 12,000 years of downcutting.
Goodness.
So it's a little bit of a guess to figure out what things looked like back then. The major rivers were certainly there, but they were moving all around, so it's a bit hard to get at it.
All right. Jess, we've discussed a lot about the environment and we've talked about the people and the settlements so far, but we haven't discovered about the environment or what you've discovered. Have you learned much about, through archaeology, what the environment was like in these times?
Yeah. It's something that we've always been aware of, cognizant of, trying to understand, but with a lot of new techniques coming out, not necessarily through archaeology, but through our colleagues in the environmental science and geological communities and wildlife biology folks, they're beginning to ask us questions about, hey, have you ever found this? Or what is your data like on trees, 5,000-year-old trees? And so my colleague Brett Ostrom and I spent spent about a year compiling all the data we had from every archaeology report about all the plant remains that were found that were identified down to species, and all the animal remains, and that's actually on a downloadable spreadsheet in the Vermont Archaeology Heritage Center website, as well as a compilation of every radiocarbon date we've run in the state as of about a year ago. And those are freely downloadable. It's just part of our mission to make as much information as we can public about this stuff without revealing things that might put the sites in danger. And so we've actually been starting to do a lot of interesting work with colleagues at Middlebury, at the University of Vermont, who are taking this data and trying to get at, say, like, well, what was potentially the size of the beaver population in Vermont before European contact at, say, 1300 AD? Or what did the forests look like before European contact? And and so we're just starting to crunch some of that data. But for instance, it appears that beech trees were much more dominant in Vermont than what is currently the predominant forest type, which is sort of a maple-based forest type. And that really dovetails in some work that's been done by our environmental scientists that think that the predominant forest in this area right at the time of European contact was beech. And then obviously people cut down, you know, about 85, 90% of the forest by about 1850.
Right.
And then slowly over the last 150, 170 years or so, they've replanted, but they've replanted differently than what's been here before.
Interesting.
Because they're choosing species that are important to them, that have, you know, good economic returns, that have some aesthetic value. So what we're seeing now in the forest is not really reflected, at least as far as we've crunched so far, in what was at the time of European contact or what was going back at least the last 5,000 years before that.
So interesting.
Yeah, get to really look back in time not only at the human landscape but the environmental landscape as well.
Well, we cleared land to live, to start farms, and for the massive sheep industry that we had here. Let's take a call. We've got Dennis joining us from Montpelier. Hi, Dennis. Go right ahead.
Hi. I'm a little confused about what happened to melt the glaciers in 18, 20,000 years ago. You said what massive cause of the global warming then compared to today? We're blaming us on global warming, but back then we weren't around.
Good point. Good, Dennis, thanks for your question.
Yeah, so it's a great question, and I am not an expert on the global cycles of warming and cooling, but there have been periodic ice ages going back, hundreds of thousands of years. I don't know how far back geologists have actually dated the earliest ice age, but it's a cyclical thing. A lot of it has to do with the tilt of the earth, with different insulation, as in solation, reflectivity. There's a number of different causes that I'm not exactly sure what precipitates it, other than it is a cyclical event. I do know in terms of our current warming trend, it is much more recent in terms of the span of the last ice age relative to one when we would expect the next ice age. You know, it's only been about 10,000 years or so. I mean, glaciers were still in the Arctic until 7,000 or 8,000 years ago, ice age glaciers. So in terms of the geological time span, we're barely out of the last one. So, you know, that's about all I can comment on.
All right. And Dennis, a great question, probably a subject for a future show, that I need to have someone on who can answer those questions for you and for all of us. We've got a couple minutes left, but I'm wondering about the agriculture of the past, you know, what we can learn from archaeology and what we know that our forebears did with this land.
Yeah, so in terms of Native American Abnaki archaeology, it's pretty interesting. Abnaki folks adopted agriculture really late compared to a lot of other people in the continent. And what I say about that is that to me is sort of a testament to just how good Vermont was at just being a hunter, a gatherer, a fisher, that there wasn't the pull to give up what you've been doing for the last, you know, 9,000 years at least, and start being a farmer.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it really took a long time for them to start saying, okay, let's plant some crops. And it did become an important seasonal resource base for them. It allowed them to aggregate surpluses, to have things you could put away for the winter. But they still were largely hunter-gatherer fishers. They were still hunting and fishing, which is a testament. But we have found a lot of recent archaeology on the Otter Creek. The Missisquoi has found early remains of corn and beans going back right around 1,000 years. But interestingly, we've found recently up in the Missisquoi sunflower that was grown around 2,500 years ago, as well as gourd. So they were growing things, but just not intensively, and as well as Chenopodium, which is an edible seed plant. It's essentially like a weed. It's not hard to grow, but it seems like they were purposely doing these small scale plots, sunflower, gourd. The gourds might have actually been used as containers rather than food back then. But they were planting things mm-hmm. quite early on, just not intensive giant cornfields until about 1,000 years ago.
We've got a minute left. Are there unanswered questions, subjects? I know there's a million of them, but of Vermont's past that you're really interested in exploring?
Yes, there's a lot of different things. It gets a little bit into the weeds. I'd just say that in terms of our indigenous friends and neighbors here in Vermont, the Abnaki, you know, the one thing that archaeology has really done in the last 40 years is 40 years ago in textbooks, it said there were never any Native Americans in Vermont. And archaeology really proves that demonstrably false, that there's a long and rich record, probably unbroken going back to the Paleo-Indian period, certainly unbroken from 9,000 years on to now, mm. Showing that people were living here, dwelling here in significant numbers, a life way that was related to Vermont. And I think that that's an important lesson that we're still learning and certainly can fill out in the future.
Jess Robinson is Vermont State Archaeologist. Jess, thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Thanks a lot, Rick. Appreciate it.
All right. We're going to take a break, and then we'll return to talk with the artist and the curator of a current exhibit at the Brattleboro Museum and Art Center. And today at 1 o'clock, David Goodman will be here for the Vermont Conversation, followed by 2 hours of The Getaway with the gregarious Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Those who love railroads never seem to get it out of their systems. Buying HO scale model trains as a kid tends to lead to a lifelong interest in the real things. Our next two guests have great interest in trains and all things rail related, and that has manifested itself in artwork that is now on display at the Brattleboro Museum and Art Center. The exhibit is titled Charlie Hunter Semaphore. Joining us now is artist Charlie Hunter. Charlie, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, thanks so much. Delighted to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you, Charlie. And the curator of the exhibit and fellow artist Eric Aho. Eric, great to have you on the program as well.
Oh, hey, guys. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Charlie or Eric questions about the current exhibit, you can give us a call at 244-1777, 877-291-TALK. That's 877-291-8255. Charlie, where is this interest in trains and railroads coming from in your life?
I think I probably just got dropped on the head one time too many as a child, but seriously, I think most right-thinking two-year-olds love trains the same way they love dinosaurs, because they're safe, they're huge and terrifying, but they're safely either in the past or are probably going to stay on those tracks. So you can get up close to them. And just like all two-year-olds, I just loved trains when I was a little kid. And then when I was like 8 years old, I was coming back from a Little League game, and the little branch line train on the Hillsborough branch through Milford, New Hampshire, came by, and the way the light was hitting the side of the boxcars, I thought was the most beautiful thing I had ever seen, and the railroad bug bit at that moment.
Wow, that's great. Now, Eric, you grew up just a few stops up the line from Charlie. What's your interest in trains?
Oh, I did. You know, Charlie and I were connected, as we've just discovered, through the rail line that connected his town of Milford and, I just lived on the other side of Nashua, New Hampshire. And my father was a railroad man. So when he mustered out after World War II, he went to work in the yards in North Station with the Boston and Maine, and then made himself a career there. I rode the lines with various hoggers through my childhood, and the railroad is sort of deep in my psyche, and for one of the reasons that I'm drawn just so deeply to Charlie's work.
Yeah, I had an uncle who worked for the railroad, the Reading Railroad, and we thought he was God. I mean, he was a cowboy. He was a police officer. He was the next best thing you could be was somebody who worked on the railroad. Charlie, describe your style of painting.
Well, I call it drippy portraits of decaying American infrastructure. it is nominally very realistic. If you look at one of the paintings from across the room, you might think it was an old photograph. Mm-hmm. But then my goal is, as the viewer gets closer to the painting, they see very painterly and passages that really aren't defined but have the illusion of detail. But mm-hmm. I tend to work very monochromatically, so it does tend to look like old photos more than old paintings, per se.
I had to double check. I had to make sure. We're talking about painting, but as I have been looking at this exhibit, I kept thinking, wait, it's paintings, right? Not photographs. So I'm glad you pointed that out. Now tell us, Charlie, about the paintings in Semaphore, which aren't exactly trains, but the items that are important to the railway operations.
I do a lot of painting where the railroad infrastructure is the subject matter, as opposed to paintings of trains. I think it was the fact that the railroad lines that I grew up with were pretty well moribund. So there weren't that many trains to get fascinated by in and of themselves. I loved kind of the haunted aspect of here is a place where this huge, this power, this movement of goods through space has occurred, but it's not occurring right now. It's this kind of suspension of the past and the future all kind of tied together. So I like kind of the haunted aspects of railroads.
Yeah, that really comes through. Eric, why did you want to curate this exhibit?
Firstly, because Charlie and I have had many conversations over many years, and we formed a camaraderie that I guess in a way formed with the railroad. Charlie put together a trip that I was very lucky to join him on, a trip on a historic rail through the wilderness of the Laurentian region of Quebec. And, Charlie and I just have stuck with it ever since. But, what Charlie's talking about here, both in his method and his reasons for choosing his subject, really the reason that motivated me to put this group of works together. Of course, as you know, I'm an artist myself, but mm-hmm. as a curator, you know, I changed hats, and I get to dig through his studio, which is a little bit like going through an old rusty rail yard, and you know, kicking the wheels and sliding the doors of these boxcars, and you never know what's inside. But you know, Charlie has this incredible ability to sort of plumb the line, or plumb the region, really. It's because it's a pretty broad region between progress and nostalgia. And, you know, we're left with these very familiar places that are, you know, that on one hand, as Charlie says, they resemble old photographs because of the sepia tones in them.
Mm-hmm.
But they're paintings, you know, so they also exist in this present moment. And we know these places, especially if you reside in New England and in the rural places of New England, you know these places and you pass them every day, and you may pass them every day without much thought. But Charlie stops on his, you know, on his way to the Shaw's Market, and he paints what he sees, or he looks at it and then he comes back to his studio and works up that image. And he's also masterful at what he removes from the scene. So it's really just, you know, the paintings end up being these records of what remains.
And what are the things, Charlie, that you do leave out, that you omit from these scenes that make the paintings that much, I don't know, more stark and more wonderful?
One can always quote Miles Davis, who said, it's not the notes you play, it's the notes you don't play.
Hmm.
Right? What I try to do, I don't know successfully or not, but what I try to do is to tell the story the most economic way possible. Mm-hmm. It's just like fiction writing, of really editing and editing and editing. How do I tell the story truthfully without extraneous fat? You know, how do I keep it to sinew and bone? So I will indicate a patch of vegetation with a brush stroke and then hit it with some water, which is the thinner I use, and it will eat away at the paint. And it gives the idea of the patch of vegetation without me having to do every single little, you know, briar and blade of grass.
Mm-hmm.
I try not to do fussy painting. And that's, you know, Eric has been a really important influence on me. Our styles of painting are very, very different.
Mm-hmm.
But Eric's kind of relentless pursuit of truth in his imagery has had a huge influence on me. I also really like the way he slops paint around.
I do too. I think he's fabulous.
That's kind of you to say, Charles.
Hey, Eric, could there be a better place for this exhibit than the Brattleboro Museum and Arts Center?
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that, because you know, the Brattleboro Museum was the station for the town of Brattleboro, and the building hasn't been built out very much. There is still the ticket booth. You can, from the platform in the back, you can see the rail lines down below, and you really get the sense of stepping back in time when you enter that building. But then the Brattleboro Museum is also doing its job, and it's addressing issues of the current moment too. So, you know, it's as much as Charlie's work transforms the viewer, the Brattleboro Museum's space transforms the experience.
It really does. I'm speaking with artists Eric Aho and Charlie Hunter. Charlie, you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, Eric's the one with vocabulary, so I'll just let him.
All right. We've got Mark on the line from Middlesex. Hi, Mark.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm wondering if your guests can speak of the efficiency of rail. I believe I read once it was 40 tons a gallon of diesel. Of course, they're diesel.
Having a hard time hearing.
I'm wondering if that's accurate. Thank you much.
All right. How about that, Charlie? The efficiency of rail, is that something? I know you're more into the art of rail, but
I'm a big advocate for rail in general. Rail is a tremendously efficient means of transporting both goods and human beings, and we have a skeletal rail system here in the state of Vermont. The state of Vermont was smart in the early 1960s when the Rutland Railroad went bankrupt. That rather than letting it get abandoned, the state purchased the tracks. And so thanks to forward thinking by, I think it was the Phil Hoff administration, the tracks remained between Bellows Falls and Rutland, between Bennington and Rutland, and between Bennington and Burlington. And that system has been rebuilt substantially between Rutland and Burlington. And the Ethan Allen service, which currently runs from New York to Rutland, will be running all the way to Burlington by next year, I believe.
Yeah, that is exciting.
Meanwhile, in the state of Vermont, we mostly use the rail for moving heavy commodities like road salt and stuff. And I would be really hopeful that in the decades to come, we shift a lot of what currently goes on highways to rail.
Mm-hmm. Eric, you mentioned being able to go and go through Charlie's paintings. How did you select the final paintings that are in Semaphore?
Well, I made several visits, and in between the visits, I really started thinking of, a kind of a core idea around the show. And the semaphore, of course, as an idea, is a beautiful abstract signal, the chevron that points us in one direction or the other. It warns us of danger, but it also, points to the, as we're discussing here, and to the caller's point, the infrastructure inherent both in a painting and in society. So, it's a very loose and a little bit abstract, right? And art sort of mines these territories. Mm-hmm. But I hoped that through presenting Charlie's paintings, we could draw greater attention both to his work and the conversation around strengthening the infrastructure both regionally and nationally. And I too am an advocate for anything that goes by rail, and including high speed passenger rail. Mm-hmm. I think that's in our future. And I hope it can become a reality, but I also have one quick question for Charlie.
Sure.
I wonder, speaking of infrastructure, I wonder if you can speak a little bit about your boyhood, in that your father's printing shop was right on the rail lines, and that's a symbol of infrastructure of a certain period. I wonder if you can talk about how that has landed with you and influenced your work.
Well, sure. The Hillsborough branch, which is where we lived in Milford, New Hampshire, till I was 11, and then we moved back to the family homestead in Wethersfield, Vermont. But in Milford, the little Hillsborough branch went from Nashua up to Hillsborough. There was a daily freight train, and it still was hauling, it was pretty much hauling commodities by that time as opposed to express service.
Right.
The Railway Express Agency was sort of the precursor to UPS and stuff, where, each depot had its own station agent, and the train would arrive, and, they would unload baby chicks and, parcels and washing machines and whatever. And then people would come down to the station and pick them up. That was pretty much gone by the time of my childhood. I do remember my father did get one press delivered by train. And then in a typical 1960s symbol of the zeitgeist, I turned the packing crate that that printing press came in into a gas station. You know, it turned into Iran. I turned it into the automotive age. So.
I love it.
Wow, good memory.
I'm going to jump track here for just a few moments. And Eric, I'd be remiss if we didn't discuss your art. Earlier this year, I had another artist on the show whose work I admire, Julia Jensen. And when I asked her about her influences, she mentioned Eric Aho, and I immediately sought you out, was blown away. Tell us a little bit about your art.
Well, I sort of stumbled into the woods and never left. I came to Vermont to take a teaching job, never having taught painting. And I was a few weeks ahead of my students, and I needed to get started with a curriculum. So I just started painting the landscape. That was 1989, and I never stopped. And they've become more abstract, more in parts more representational, but they're about experiences in nature.
And they really are transformative. Check out the work of Eric Aho.
You.
Now, Charlie, I want to ask you about your life before painting. You have kind of a rock and roll past. Tell us about the tour posters that you used to create.
You've done your research. when I was in college, I had a dream job for a college student, which was I worked at a rock nightclub doing all the artwork in the windows. And it was a showcase club. It was where acts would play before they went out on the road big time. So we had U2 before U2's record got released. We had Springsteen used to come and play there, after he'd done the show at the Coliseum and stuff. Anyway, my work got seen by a company that did tour posters for bands. It wasn't directly working for the bands. It was working for these middle agents that would route, if an album flopped, the tour would get routed to college campuses. And so we would do the tour posters for Squeeze or REM or The Clash when they were doing, 40 different colleges. We would do posters for each of those college dates, and I would design those. And it's just been a wonderful, talking point for my later life. And, of course, it's a blast doing that kind of design when you're in your 20s,
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Eric, tomorrow night at 7:30 at the museum, the Brattleboro Museum and Art Center, there's going to be a conversation with the two of you. What will people hear from the two of you tomorrow, different from what they're hearing this morning on this show?
Well, I think we'll cover some of the same points. Because Charlie's biography and the reasons behind these paintings are just fascinating. They're fascinating to me, and I'm sure they'll be of great interest to people coming to his work anew. And and Charlie has a tremendous following too. So there'll be certainly a lot of discussion. Sorry.
I said tremendous.
No, there'll be a lot of discussion. There'll be a lot of discussion about painting and the nature of putting this stuff on a canvas and why we do that.
Charlie, are you insinuating that we're going to need extra security patrol tomorrow night at the museum?
Well, they've actually decided that we're just going to do it remotely.
Ah, okay.
Since we're blathering, it's not necessary for everyone to gather. They'll have slides of the pictures of the paintings as we're discussing them and stuff. So I think we're going to be okay.
Yeah, no bouncers for this concert.
Exactly.
Oh, thank goodness. All right. Charlie Hunter's exhibit, Semaphore, on display now at the Brattleboro Museum and Art Center. And you can also see it online at brattleboromuseum.org. Eric Aho is an artist, the curator of this exhibit, and the artist and curator conversation will take place tomorrow, 7:30, and again, you can find it at BrattleboroMuseum.org. Eric and Charlie, this has been a lot of fun. Thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Oh, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. Take care, both of you. We're going to take a break for CBS News, and then we'll be back to talk about caterpillars. And coming up today at 11, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. All right, now it's time to get out into nature and visit our friends, the caterpillars. The folks at the North Branch Nature Center have a big event dedicated to the caterpillar beginning tomorrow, and we've got them with us now to hear all about it. Joining us is Executive Director of the Nature Center and co-host of For the Birds on WDEV, Chip Darmstadt. Chip, thanks for being here.
Hey, Rick. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing? Great.
Doing well, thanks.
Okay, and we've got the Director of Natural History Programming, Sean Beckett. Sean, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right, great to have you. Now, listeners, if you've got caterpillar questions for Sean and Chip, you can call us now at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also go to VT Viewpoint or send us an email at vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Sean, what is so special about caterpillars?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, I think everybody is pretty familiar with, you know, monarch caterpillars and milkweed and kind of the story there. And often when we think of caterpillars, that's kind of what we think of. Maybe those are those little woolly bears that that kind of are crossing our sidewalks in the fall. But right. There are thousands of species of caterpillars in just in Vermont alone. And they are really the thing that underpin the entire food web and make everything else possible, from the mammals, the birds, you know, everything that we see when we walk through nature. In many ways, caterpillars and their presence in the landscape are responsible for it. So they're worth celebrating.
Now, Sean, is the Caterpillar Lab, though, a PR move generated by the gypsy moths to make up for the destruction that they did bring this spring to some areas of the state?
You know, so we're moving away from calling them gypsy moths. The scientific community has not landed on a new common name for them, but we've been calling them the LD moths or Limantria moths. Limantria, as far as their scientific name. And, you know, for as destructive as they've been, in the Northeast this year, they are, when you just stop and look at one, they're pretty remarkable. Their life cycle, their natural history, how they do what they do. And, you know, I often, when I've been over in Burlington or Rutland or other places where there's been some big outbreaks, I think you can be concerned about the devastation that they've had on the forest in certain places, while also thinking, man, what a cool-looking insect, and what a neat story it has.
Sean, you're very good. All right, now, Chip, explain why you are holding the Caterpillar Lab there at North Branch Nature Center.
Rick, I just want to chime in, too, about the destructive moths we have in Vermont and you know, the country are, you know, far outnumbered by beneficial moths and caterpillars. So, you know, Sean mentioned all the species we have in here in Vermont, and they are the foundation of the food chain. And, you know, many moths and butterflies are pollinators, so they perform a lot of important services for sure. And they're really cool. The reason we have the Caterpillar Lab here for almost every year for many years now is because they're fascinating and beautiful, and we want to share that with everyone. So the Caterpillar Lab travels around New England with this mobile caterpillar zoo, and these are remarkable creatures. So, you know, people often ask, you know, what good is this creature or that creature, this animal, that animal? And you know, for caterpillars, yeah, they do a lot for us and birds and nature in general, but they're also just beautiful and fascinating in their own right. So it's the kind of thing you have to see it to believe it. You know, we often see a cabbage white caterpillar in our garden, think, oh, that's gross, or a tobacco hornworm. But there are so many cool caterpillars, and you just got to see them to believe them.
Yeah. What will be covered over the 5 days, Chip?
Well, we've got lots of things going on. Sean, jump in here if I'm forgetting anything, but we have caterpillar camps for kids. We have a caterpillar institute for educators. And we have these open days, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, where anyone can come and check out the caterpillars. Those are 10 to 5 on, I think, Saturday and Monday, and 1 to 5 on Sunday. Did I have that right, Sean?
That's right, yep.
And, Sean, you open up tomorrow, Friday as well, with these caterpillar camps. So what happens at those?
Well, the caterpillar camps are for kids. They're ages, various camps are ages 6 through 13. And essentially the Caterpillar Lab staff are going to be starting out, taking the kids around the exhibit, looking at all of the cool, weird caterpillars that they bring. It's hard to overstate just how wacky and amazing some of these species are that they're going to be showing off. And we have like the hickory horn devil, which is a native. All these species that they're bringing are native, but it's this caterpillar that's bigger than a hot dog, and it's full of sparkles and colors and horns and all sorts of weird things. It looks like something out of either an alien movie or something right out of like the Amazon rainforest, but it's native here. And they have a whole exhibit of things like this, things like that, things that are so well camouflaged that there could be 50 of them on one little branch in front of you, and you wouldn't see a single one until they were pointed out. So the kids will be checking out that exhibit, trying to find the camouflage ones, and trying to maybe holding some of these hot dog caterpillars and kind of enjoying that, and then going out into the field here at the Nature Center, into the woods with the Caterpillar Lab staff, and finding these things, in the wild.
Oh, Sean, and, I'm totally intrigued already. Are there still openings for the camps?
The camps have actually just filled up this morning.
Feel free
to hop on the wait list. If you go to our website, northbranchnaturecenter.org, you can see the whole event list. And so if you're a parent interested in getting your kids into a caterpillar camp, feel free to join the wait list. But also, I want to just stress that the events that are happening over the weekend, September 4th through 6th, Saturday through Monday, the public exploration exhibit. This is where the whole exhibit is on display for anyone who wants to drop by. It's perfectly family friendly. If you can't get into the caterpillar camp, bring the whole family to the events happening over the weekend, and all of that will be on display and there for you to check out.
Oh, that's such a great point. Chip, Friday night, you're having a moth party out there. What's this all about? And what times is it? It's kind of late.
Well, there's two moth nights. There's Friday night, which is a by registration event where you really dive deep into moth biology and learn about attracting moths and identifying them. And then Sunday night is a, I don't think there's registration. Sean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's a moth.
There's an RSVP.
Okay.
So we can make sure that, that way we know how many people are coming. But
gotcha.
Yeah, the public one is Sunday night.
Yeah, that's 8:30 to 11:30. So we'll be out for most of the night trying to attract moths to some white sheets we'll put up, and you put out special lights. And we're all familiar with how moths are attracted to lights, and we'll be intentionally bringing moths into the lights in this event. And, the caterpillars are one thing. They're incredibly diverse and just interesting to watch and cool behaviors. And then there's the adult moths, which are fascinating and beautiful as well, with intricate patterns and colors. And we tend to dismiss moths. Love butterflies, but often moths kind of are, we just don't give them a second glance. But when you see them up close and you see their intricate patterns and colorations, they're really awesome creatures, and we could attract dozens of species in a single night.
And as you mentioned before, they are pollinators, and we love pollinators. Let's go to Stephen joining us from Montpelier. Hi, Stephen. Go right ahead.
Hi. I have a question. What is the real difference between a caterpillar and a worm?
Ah, okay. Who wants to take that? The difference between a caterpillar and a worm, Sean or Chip?
I could jump in, and I recognize that voice. Hi, Stephen. Chip. Well, caterpillars are the larvae of the Lepidoptera. So all the moths and all the butterflies, all their larvae are caterpillars. Worms are annelids, which is a whole different phylum. So, you know, remember learning in high school biology about various kingdoms of life? Under kingdom, you get phylum, and these are big groups of organisms. So the arthropods are a phylum, for example, and the worms are a phylum. So they are annelids or in this phylum, annelida, and they do not metamorphose into something as wonderful as a butterfly or moth. They'll basically look the same throughout their life cycle, just getting bigger and bigger to some extent.
And Sean, do worms and caterpillars interact in any way? Do they get along? Do they just ignore each other?
Well, they have, you know, ecologically speaking, the big difference between worms and caterpillars is that, you know, worms are, we all know where to go to find worms, and that's to, you know, flip some soil over and look in your garden. Mm-hmm. So worms are really, you know, decomposers that are, they're feeding in the soil substrate and under the leaf litter. Whereas caterpillars are up on the leaves of our herbaceous plants and our trees. So worms and caterpillars, you know, don't cross paths very much, except perhaps maybe, you know, a lot of moths and butterflies will lay their eggs actually in the leaf litter or even underground. Mm-hmm. And so maybe when those caterpillars are emerging from their eggs, they might pass by and wave to a worm on their way up to the surface and up a tree.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Fred joining us from Newbury. Hi, Fred.
Morning.
Morning.
Hey, if you take, let's see here. Oh, how about this? Is a leech, a worm, a caterpillar, or a fish, or possibly a snake?
Okay. All right. What is a leech, and is it in any relation to worms, caterpillars, fish, or snake? Who's got Ooh. That one?
Sean, are they an annelid as well, related to worms?
If memory serves, I think they're annelids. So if you were to, I think they're most closely related to the worms, but even then, they're a different story. So we know fish, of course, living underwater and being blood parasites on fish, on turtles, on us when we go to our favorite swimming holes.
Yeah.
Leeches are actually, you know, they're worth a second glance as well. You know, maybe sometime when there's not one attached to you and you're trying to get it off, just seeing one swimming around in the water, we actually have some really ornately patterned, colored leeches that are quite beautiful, at least from the outside of the water looking in.
Well, I'll know, Chip and Sean, if you have a leech lab next year, it will be dedicated to Fred in Newbury, who inspired it. All right, let's go to Dee in Duxbury next. Hi, Dee.
Hi. It wasn't until last year that I looked closely at tent caterpillars. Mm-hmm. You know, you can see it on trees, and I thought, looked really close. What do those caterpillars do in there?
So there's several different species of tent caterpillars. So there's the eastern tent caterpillar and the forest tent caterpillar. And it's really only the eastern tent caterpillar that makes those webby nests in the crotches of branches. There's also something called a fall webworm, which I'm looking at some out my window right now. The webbing encases the whole branch out to the tip. So that's where the young are hanging out and are protected from predators. And then I think, I'm not sure about this, but I think they venture out at night to feed, but that gives them a safe place to hide out from potential predators like cuckoos during the day.
Mm. All right. So, we are talking about
a lot of folks call us asking about the forest tent caterpillars this time of year. Everything we're seeing right now is that fall webworm, so it's actually a different thing than we're seeing in the spring.
All right. And Sean, we were talking about moths, you know, how they don't get the love compared to butterflies. Now, I know with butterflies, we like to grow things like milkweed and butterfly bushes. Anything that we can do to help out our friends, the moths?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, I think that a lot of folks think that this, like, the relationship between monarch and milkweed is kind of an exception, how there's that specialized thing where monarch caterpillars can only grow on milkweed. But that's actually more the rule than the exception. Almost every species of caterpillar, moth or butterfly, depends on a host plant. And so for every, you know, if you look out the window wherever you are, every single one of those species of plants you're seeing has one, if not more, species of caterpillars that depend on just that species or just species in that genera. And so, if you're trying to take care of your moth, diversity, then, one of the best things you can do is just diversify the plants in your yard. Planting native plants, of course, but a good diversity of plants is the best thing you can do to diversify the types of moths that you're supporting throughout their various life stages.
Now, Chip, we've been talking about caterpillars, the Caterpillar Lab starting tomorrow at North Branch Nature Center. And unfortunately, every creature out in out there in nature is sitting somewhere on the food chain. So I hate to bring up this discussion, bring it down a little. But who's checking out the caterpillar and thinking, that's a rather juicy menu item?
Oh, you know, birds, of course.
Yeah.
Hey, and just to quickly piggyback on what Sean said,
okay,
too, in addition to planting native species, less lawn, too. You know, the less lawn we have, the more diverse plant community we have on our property, the more butterflies and moths we'll have and their caterpillars. And, yes, they are so important to birds. Most of our nesting birds, especially the migratory ones, think about all the warblers and the grosbeaks. Just about any bird is feeding insects, often caterpillars, through their young. So even a species that might feed on, you know, seeds or berries, they're often feeding caterpillars to their young, and caterpillars are just like, they're made to be bird food. They're like perfect. They're soft and tender. Not all of them, but they're great bird food. So without a robust caterpillar population, we would not have as many birds here in Vermont.
All right, and we love having a nice, diverse bird population, so that just follows that we love having caterpillars here. Sean, you mentioned that we have so many different species of caterpillars, so what are a few of your favorites that you hope people will see at the Caterpillar Lab this weekend?
Well, sure. I mean, the hickory horned devil is certainly the showstopper, I think. That's that hot dog-sized green and red and orange and black and yellow you know, monstrous-looking, amazing creature that it'll be around. But there's all sorts of geometers, moths as well, caterpillars that have just incredible camouflage. They look exactly like the twigs of their host species. And so just the game of trying to find some of these caterpillars on their host plants is really cool. And maybe, you know, the thing that last time the Caterpillar Lab was in town, the thing that I learned from them that was just drop dead amazing to me, and such a great story. And these are the kinds of stories that you'll walk away with if you come to Caterpillar Lab. There's this species of caterpillar called the butterfly is called a silvery blue. It's a little blue tiny butterfly that's really common throughout Vermont in the spring, and its caterpillar specializes on vetch. Purple vetch. And this is a plant that you find in sidewalk cracks and the edges of parking lots. Like there's nothing special or rare about vetch. And so this story is happening just everywhere around us, whether you're in, you know, downtown Montpelier or you're out in the wilderness. And this caterpillar, it makes a little dewdrop, of, you know, sugary substance. But in that sugary substance is laced with a chemical like dopamine. And there's a kind of ant that's when it comes across this and it tastes that dewdrop, it gets addicted to this dewdrop. It stops whatever it's doing. The whole colony just gives up on being an ant colony, and they spend the rest of their lives guarding this caterpillar, waiting for it to produce this dopamine-laced dewdrop. And of course, the caterpillar benefits by having these guard ants surrounding it at all times, protecting it from anything that might get in the way of it producing that dewdrop. And so, you know, we have basically, you know, a caterpillar that is producing a drug addiction to our local ant species. And all of this is just happening like literally in a sidewalk crack. And so, you know, you see interactions like this, you see these stories, at the Caterpillar lab pulled up on their big projection microscopes on the big screen. You know, looking at these little things that are just a couple of millimeters in length, but they take up the whole side of the wall when you're hearing the story.
I am gobsmacked. That was well worth the price of admission. Sean Beckett is the Director of Natural History Programming at the North Branch Nature Center. Chip Darmstadt is the Executive Director. And to learn more about the Caterpillar Lab that starts tomorrow, you can visit northbranchnaturecenter.org. Chip and Sean, that was great. Thanks so much for being on this morning.
Thank you, Rick. We appreciate it.
All right. Take care, guys. All right, bye. That is our show for today of Vermont Viewpoint, directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. And it is sponsored by The Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre up next. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.